36. Ms. Folks, would you do a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey? Dr. Raitt?
Present.
Ms. Denton?
Present.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. This discussion is going to involve a lot of the community partners out there, fellow behavior analysts, and I appreciate you all taking the time out of your day to come visit. Board staff, thanks for compiling the agenda, and I know there's some research that's going to be presented in one of the items too, so I appreciate that. Let's move on to agenda item number 4. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the model practice acts of the BACB and the APBA. That item appears to be a little bit more relevant with agenda items 10 and 11. I propose that we move that to just between 9 and 10. Is there any issue with that at all? Okay. All right. Ms. Galvin, do we need to make a motion for that, or can we just...
No, not at all. You're free to do that.
All right. That's great. Okay. All right. Agenda item number 5, discussion with stakeholders and consideration and possible action regarding licensure and regulation as it relates to the entire scope of practice of behavior analysis in Arizona. This is a fairly large item. We did reach out to some possible community partners to discuss this, but people weren't available. And if anybody is feels that they want to discuss this, that's fine. I know we have some information to share with the community as well. Ms. Packanon, this is the item that the intern did some work in. Okay, so would you mind sharing that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. So at least one component of the material that I think that will help inform this discussion is the research that you asked us to do specific to gathering information on the, how other jurisdictions define behavior analysis, how they define client or patient, and also the license exemptions that exist, if any, in those jurisdictions. So to give credit where it's due, our student intern collected the information that's presented in the matrix that you have. It's not a comprehensive report of all states. There are some states who, after multiple requests, did not respond with that information. But our intern did her best to look in the statutes and rules and then to reach out when she needed additional information or clarity. So I think that there's a lot of material to go over. And so I agree with you. This is a big discussion and will probably need to be revisited over time. And then hopefully we are able to secure some subject matter experts who can help this committee and our stakeholders sort of appreciate scope of practice, how it's evolving, where it's evolving toward, and keeping regulatory concerns and needs in mind. So I'm interested in hearing if there are other individuals we can reach out to for future discussions.
Any other comments on that at this time?
Mr. Chair, and I think I said this in the previous meetings too, but I just want to keep it at the forefront because it aligns with some of our conversations around where psychological practice is required to be licensed as well. And that would be that we incorporate or include stakeholders from the OBM community, because I think that's the challenge. You know, with psychology, the industrial organizational psychologists don't have to be licensed given the nature of the work that they're doing, where the way that our statute currently reads, I'm concerned that those OBM professionals would need to be, and they're doing very similar, although different methodologies, very similar work. And so I definitely, Corbin agrees, would like to see that that those community members be involved in this conversation so that we can really discuss the impact that our current licensing has on their ability to practice, but then also to have that conversation around truly what our role in protecting the public is. And I know we talked about, you know, some OBM professionals are really working in the area of safety, and does that then cross over and those sorts of things. But I definitely would agree that there needs to be stakeholders representing those areas of work to be able to give us that expertise.
Other BCBAs that are on the call, any discussion about that as well? This has been a topic that we've been discussing for several months now, and as Dr. Davis Wilson mentioned, is what are the parameters in which licensure should be in place and should not, and so any feedback on that or ideas, or you know, at least some initial discussion about what might be the limits of where licensure is required and it is not required. Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, this is Carrie Baranek. I heard Ms. Pakkinen mention a matrix and other organizations. Apologies if I didn't see that or have it, but were there other state agencies that provided information on OBM and the applicability of licensure?
Mr. Chair, do you want me to field that question?
Yes, please. Yeah, Ms. Pakkinen, thank you.
Ms. Baranek, so what I described was just some research that one of our interns did at the direction of this committee. The committee was interested in learning how other states, other jurisdictions are defining certain terms and what their licensure exemptions consist of. This is all, you know, public record, so you're welcome to request that and I'll happily share it with you. It was assembled and prepared for the committee to review, but it's not necessarily focused on, you know, OBM or anything in particular. This information, I think, has some applicability to this discussion and probably other discussions as well. It's been some time, I think, since we've collected information from other states and sort of, you know, compared it to what our language is in Arizona. So it's really just that, you know, collecting this information to inform this discussion and probably others.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Ms. Pakkinen, Dr. Stenhoff, would it be possible just to pull up the matrix and share the screen just for a minute to show her what we're referring to?
Yeah, I can, if everyone will bear with me while I make sure that I have that functionality on my with my Zoom settings. I do.
We don't have to discuss it in detail, but you can just give the others an idea what we're referring to.
Certainly. While I do that, let's have everyone just continue the discussion. It'll take me a couple of minutes to pull that up.
Mr. Chairman, I can chime in as well. This is Dr. Rates, and maybe potentially answer that last question, but I think other states do have some exemptions and talk specifically about the practice of OBM. So I want to thank board staff, because that was very helpful as we dive in to kind of look at how are others looking at that practice specifically and where that falls within the larger licensure discussion. I found that to be really helpful. So thank you.
Okay, can everyone see my screen now?
Yes.
Great. So essentially, the way that Caitlin, Ms. Doherty, prepared this is just organized it by state, of course. Let me see if I can change this a little bit. Better, okay. So by state, definition of behavior analysis or practice of behavior analysis, definition of client or patient. depending on how the jurisdiction, which term that they use, in some cases both. And then, if any, there were the exemptions to licensure that are presented here too. So I think there were some 20 some states that she was able to collect information from. So it's a lot of material.
Hi, Ms. Pakkinen. I should comment as we're looking at this, the matrix for definitions. This is Kyle Leininger. I recall that there was a proposal for striking some language according to the definition that's existed, previously. I don't know if it would be helpful for folks to, on the call to become aware of that, just relative to the definition itself as it pertains to scope.
Yes, indeed. I do recall that the committee at their previous meeting in January had identified some language in that definition, yes, and recommended or prepared to recommend that it be removed. Of course, that process would involve the committee making the recommendation to the board, and then ultimately the board would have to seek sponsorship of a bill to accomplish that and a host of other changes that the committee and board are considering. So the way it's reflected in the minutes, striking the second sentence of the definition of behavior analysis. I'd have to go back and see what that actually consists of. Oh, okay. It's reflected here in the minutes. I'm sorry. So the sentence currently reads behavior analysis does not include. And I think the committee's recommendation was that that sentence doesn't need to be there any longer. Is that how the committee remembers it as well?
Yeah.
Hey, Mr. Chair, Ms. Pakkinen, I do think that, and perhaps it's just a matter of me doing it, as she was looking at the definitions, and I know we were looking at this from multiple different angles, but with regard to this particular agenda item, I think understanding who it applies to is important. But to, Mr. Langer's point, I think one of the issues that at least I'm forecasting when we go to present it to the full board is I think we're going to run into some areas of potential kind of argument. And so I would be interested in having a list of states that do not, because I was looking at the Model Licensing Act and very similar language is in APBA's Model Licensing Act, which it's difficult to try to make a change like this when, our other stakeholders have the same language in there. But I think that if we could find language that other states are using that does align more with what our stakeholders are trying to communicate as a need, that might be a good basis. Because if we turn and we use that Model Licensing Act, the Model Licensing Act has that language in there. And so I think going through this and figuring out what states are not specifically saying, hey, behavior analysis doesn't include this myriad of different things that it mm-hmm. that it doesn't, if that makes sense. But
just to clarify, are you looking for a state that models that language from the APBA closely?
No, our state models the language closely. We're recommending that sentence be removed And so I'd want to see other states that don't model that closely, because that's the difficulty, is if we say, hey, here's our professional, you know, association that does this kind of work and their Model Licensing Act. And then you read the Model Licensing Act, the verbiage is almost verbatim from the Model Licensing Act from APVA. So if we're going to articulate that we need to strike that sentence, I think we need to have a clear understanding of where else that's stricken. Now, I can tell you an understanding is that no other profession in the behavioral health world or even other has a defined what you don't do into practice, into statutes. And so that's kind of the perspective that our local association is looking at, and Mr. Leininger has advocated and discussed that with us, of like, we aren't telling psychologists and counselors and all these people what they can't do. We list what it includes, and then the rest is a scope of practice issue that you know can be addressed. But my concern is if we look at it either from this matrix, which Alabama looked like they had a little bit of an exclusion, not one that I think is a big deal. But if we look straight at the Model Licensing Act, our language is almost identical to the Model Licensing Act, which, I mean, I personally support where Mr. Leininger is coming from. And I, for me, it comes down to how do we articulate it when so many other states have this same language? And the language exists because it's from the Model Licensing Act. So, I mean, so you see it in all these states. See,
yes.
And then that's going to be my concern with trying to articulate. And I'm not saying that we don't. I think that we can definitely try, but I want to be practical in our expectations of what the full board may be looking for. And so any states that we can say, look, this is how they've defined it, and we would like to mirror this, the better, because otherwise we're up against our own stakeholders saying that this language needs to be in there.
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing a mix of states with similar language and then others that don't sort of address what is not in the scope of practice.
Yeah. I think even if we just had a total of, you know, of the 32 states that have licensure, 28 of them have this and or don't have it or whatever. But some, I think there's going to need to be some sort of robust argument on the side of why that needs to be removed. Like I said, I support the argument. I understand it. But it's difficult when it's been something that's been kind of adopted by stakeholders already.
Dr. Wilson, this is Kyle Leininger. Is it possible that that kind of how you use the resource of this intern to kind of pull this information, which looks, you know, quite extensive, to do what you just proposed, which is maybe doing kind of this account of state by state, like how many states have that language versus not?
Yeah, I feel like this tool, and it, like I don't know, unless the intern wants to just do a quick run through of that language and add the actual numbers, I'm happy to look at it as well. But yeah, I think that this breakdown gives us that information, and we absolutely could use that as a potential argument, if you will, to try to help support why this is needed. And we may also, and Dr. Davies not on the line, but we may also be able to get the stakeholder perspective as to why that was included. And if I recall, it's been a conversation at the APBA level before, And it's kind of had mixed reviews, one of which that some of the people are like, well, it isn't what we do, so why not have it in there? And others that recognize by having it in there, we take down the red tape of behavior analysis for psychology, which has been like this ongoing, like little like back end feud. And so I think that it might be in there as language to proactively move a licensure act forward, knowing that that's a common barrier that they run into. But I don't know. But I do think looking at these other states and saying like, hey, there's plenty of states that are operating without it. I just, like I said, I fear using like the Model Licensing Act or other language that then kind of makes that argument difficult.
I'm a little cautious about being too prescriptive as well in the language. Proposed to strike the language in that original, in the original language, because I think we've seen the evolution of behavior analysis and because of some of the new technologies coming out in our field and the expansion of areas that we're tapping into, and we have been doing for decades, but it's becoming more apparent and more direct. And so I get concerned that we might be too prescriptive and narrow ourselves. So I think a broader or more general definition would be best than saying we do X, Y, and Z. So that's a concern I have.
Mr. Chair, I completely agree with that. And I agree with, like I said, the committee has already taken kind of a stance on this. I'm just looking for creative avenues from stakeholders to help me articulate this to the full board. So I agree. And you know, another point that I would add to all of that is we just went through a sunset audit. And one of the things that kind of was a common theme was there's a lot of prescription in the behavior analysis statutes that aren't consistent with other statute writing. And their recommendation is that in a lot of those cases, we develop rule instead of statute. And we have rules pertaining to that. We have scope of practice rules. We have ethics codes all pertaining to that. So it really is, as you put it, Dr. Senhoff, this really is a matter of being super prescriptive in the statute that doesn't allow for any flexibility. Not that the rules necessarily do either, but I think that that's one of the arguments that I would make is that we did just go through a sunset audit and there was a common theme that behavior analyst statutes were prescriptive and prescriptive above and beyond what other statutes in the state of Arizona are. And so most definitely prepared to articulate that. And I'm prepared to articulate that this issue is covered in our rules and in our ethics code. I just want to also proactively acknowledge that this is a common language set forth by one of our largest professional associations. And that tends to be a bit of a hiccup when it comes to arguing these types of points.
Yes, well said. All right, any further discussion on this? Okay, I propose that we do come back to this and revisit in future meetings, but If there's no other comments, let's move on to agenda item 6.
Sorry, this is Dr. H. The only thing I might say is if we can pull the numbers as suggested previously for how many states have their definition differently than that of ours, and maybe even if we can pull that language together out of the larger document. So when we have this discussion moving forward, we might have some examples with which we can look at if we want to make some recommendations.
Yeah, that sounds great. Anything else? Thank you, Dr. Reyes. Okay. So let's move on to agenda item number 6, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding application processing timeframes. Ms. Packman, would you mind leading that discussion?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I will just sort of provide some recent historical context, but I believe that what we want to achieve today is some conversations with the stakeholders relative to the application processing and granting timeframes. I do want to provide some information and some data where it is relevant. But in recent weeks, we've had two stakeholders reach out to us to express some concerns with the perceived delays in processing applications and issuing licenses. And in the case of the first instance, was a conversation with a stakeholder in our state who we just spoke, you know, on the phone or over Zoom, I think it was, and sort of talked about how the board is challenged significantly being on the receiving end and exclusively on the receiving end of information submitted to support an application. And so, you know, we do our best to try to, you know, notify applicants of what the deficiencies are in their file and to, you know, respond as we can to requests for updates. You know, do you have this material? Has someone sent this to you on my behalf and so forth? That being said, we receive an enormous amount of inquiries that are very, very difficult to respond to as promptly as we would like. We also struggle at times with materials that are sent to us that don't comply with the requirements. And so they have to be, we have to notify the applicant, you know, that what you sent is assuredly going to be rejected by the committee because it doesn't conform to the requirements, establishing rule and so forth. So there's a lot of back and forth that happens in the course of even, you know, typical applications. So that being said, that's one struggle that we're trying to deal with. I did also look at this from the timeframes perspective, and I think that the timeframes are not always understood by applicants or by the stakeholder community in general. The timeframes are such that we need to conform to in terms of the administrative completeness timeframe and the substantive review timeframe. So the administrative completeness timeframe is, of course, the timeframe where we are accepting materials, receiving materials. And so once we issue the deficiency letter to an applicant, that stops the clock on the administrative timeframe. So what appears to be, you know, a timeframe violation is not. It's actually a suspension of that timeframe until all materials are received, and then the application shifts into the substantive review timeframe. So that is, I think, pretty well illustrated in the response that I issued to the second stakeholder. And I know you've been provided with the letter from that group that, you know, expressed concerns with our processing timeframes. And so, you know, I wanted to respond with, you know, data to support that we're actually doing quite well. We do need to address some of the issues in the administrative timeframe, which I want to speak to in a moment. But with respect to the substantive review timeframe, this committee and the board are doing an excellent job, coming in well under, you know, the timeframe duration. So what we our deficits in the administrative timeframe, which are small, are more than made up for in the substantive review timeframe. But I do want to acknowledge that we have some pain points, and I've discussed those with anyone who asks about them. We have a licensing processing system that is woefully deficient, so deficient that this is a bit of a spoiler alert for our board member who's present today. I'm going to be asking the board to do a critical evaluation of the system and some other opportunities that I think could potentially better serve this agency and applicants and the entire stakeholder community. So we do need to reform our technology. And we also are very hopeful that we will be adding another staff member at a halftime level to the team in July, assuming that the legislature does approve of that request. So we have to have permission to add that other position and also to fund it. And so far, I'm encouraged, but I don't yet have I haven't seen the appropriations bill yet. So until I see the bill, I'm just cautiously optimistic. I'm happy to answer any questions too about this issue.
Thank you, Ms. Packman. Any questions?
Hi, this is Dr. Adam Hawes. Hey, board. It's good to see everyone. One of the things that I think is of issue is not the time frame from which the file is complete to its review, but prior to that tenure, upon submission of documentation, given the latency of responses to applications, things of that nature. I read the response from the board to one of the stakeholders and thought it was, you know, cogently explained. But I speak for at least my organization, and that I don't believe that's the time period of concern or of question. I think it's from the initiation of the application and the discussion and responsivity to inquiries about incomplete applications in the interim to it being complete that is of question. I don't know if other stakeholders have had similar experiences, but I think it's less about the complete application to a decision being rendered and more about the initiation of the application to it then being complete.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Packanon, and perhaps since back in November, I brought these similar concerns forward to the committee, and we were able to get some responses related to it. And perhaps this might be a good time to discuss some of those responses. But I also want to revisit a discussion that we had with the Sunset Audit. So starting with just what was brought forth in November. So obviously this has been a stakeholder conversation that has been brought to our attention. There were a few things that we acknowledged in November, one of which being delays around COVID. To give a little bit of just kind of, and this is more of for perspective for stakeholders, one of the things that we do that not every state does is we do not just accept the certification as a pathway to licensure. And when COVID happened, there were also a lot of applicants that that couldn't get their transcripts because the universities were closed or couldn't have. And we need that first party verification, right? We need the actual source to send that information in. And so there were a bunch of kind of hiccups with COVID that happened. Now, one of the things that we also acknowledged with COVID, and I want to both commend but bring to the table so that, because we're having this conversation, was that, we did have a staff member express concern with working from home and trying to navigate working from home and, the application files and all of those sorts of things of trying to figure out how to make it work with as quickly as things are coming. And I want to acknowledge the fact that, I mean, we're getting upward 20 applicants, plus a month just at the approval stage, which means we got a lot backed up before that. We are growing astronomically. And so I want to note that since that conversation in November, there has been some administrative efficiencies put into place to try to help address some of that. But at the end of the day, the workload is greater than just what one person can have. But I think that, and Dr. Haas, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I'm going to say it a little bit more less eloquent just to make sure that I'm understanding your concern, but your concern is correspondence between applicant and board staff, right? The email response times, confirmation times. So it's not necessarily, and please know this is not in any way intended to target any staff members. It's to really just acknowledge that some of the concerns that at least what I'm hearing aren't even the delays themselves, but just the lack of communication between those delays, the extended lack of communication when trying to access, hey, where are we at with this? Is this complete? Those sorts of things. And again, I know that we talked briefly about it in November, but perhaps that's something that we can revisit again. The other thing that I want to mention, you know, it came up with the historical or with the it came up with the sunset audit where they asked us, why don't you guys just take the certification and you know, forego this first party verification process? There's other states that are successfully doing it that way. Why are you guys not? And that was a question that was presented to us. I have had a lot happen since then, including a baby. So I don't recall the exact response that came from that, Ms. Pacnan, perhaps you do. But I do believe, and Ms. Folks, you also may know, I do believe that there are other kind of statutory requirements that kind of put us in this position of needing to still do the first party verification, because there are other statutory requirements outside of the behavior analyst statute that would then also have to change. But perhaps Ms. Pacnan or Ms. Folks, you guys can talk to that. But also, I do believe that in a conversation with the committee, we have identified discrepancies between what the Behavior Analyst Certification Board has approved and what we've seen. So for example, when we get the supervisor hours, someone might have like 1,430 hours, yet the BACB may have missed that they didn't get the 1,500 hours, or someone may have missed a course and that was not caught by the BACB. And so that was of concern, was that we've had multiple occurrences where when we do our verification, the individual isn't even eligible for certification. And we've sent that information over to the BACB as well to say, hey, were you, you guys, you know, we have a discrepancy here. So I think that's, you know, I'm absolutely willing to, you know, revisit the conversation of the first party verification stuff, provided we don't have other state laws getting in the way of that. But I just wanted to bring in kind of all of those pieces, because this isn't a new topic, but I do think it's one that needs to be addressed if we can come up with a solution to resolve it. Because, and I think the letter nicely puts it, I mean, this is an access to care issue. And if we're here for public protection and we know that these services are necessary for these individuals, then I think as a group, we need to figure out what's going to be the solution that works best, and then take that argument forward to the board and say, hey, here's why we need to advocate for this change. And again, one of the changes already recommended to us is, why don't we just take what the BACB is doing? Why recreate the wheel and create that extra work? And perhaps that would address the excessive amount of work. I even looked at Texas's application, and you want to talk about reduction of workload, like that could really solve some of these issues. If we were to look not just at Texas, but at what other states are doing and re-examine that recommendation. Sorry, Ms. Pacman, I don't know if you had anything else to add.
Mr. Chair, no, I mean, I think that you, we did a very nice job of not only, you know, describing the committee's perspective, which is the substantive, you focus on the substantive review portion of the process. Staff is responsible for the administrative review process, of course, but yet I I think you have tremendous insight into what that looks like. And Ms. Galvin can sort of back me up on this. But the statutes in Title 41 that essentially they're known as the Administrative Procedures Act, they presume that applications for licensure undergo what's called a substantive review process. And in every case and in every licensing board that I've ever had insight into anyway, that process does involve a review of all content of the substance of the application and all of the material supplied to ascertain whether the qualifications are met or not. And so to essentially defer to, you know, another organization, and in this case, the certification board, really, at least this board feels that it's a departure or it's delegating that substantive review process to another entity, which would be inconsistent with the APA, with the Administrative Procedures Act. Am I speaking accurately on that, Jean?
Yes, that's correct.
So in other words, it's not as simple as to say, you know, we can create an application that emulates that of Texas or Oregon, where we just say, great, you're certified. And so, you know, these requirements are met. That, again, that substantive review needs to be performed by first the committee and affirmed by the board. So just again, to reiterate, I mean, I really do want stakeholders to understand that the challenges that we experience at the administrative review phase of the process, we're trying very hard to address multiple pain points. We know we're understaffed. Unfortunately, with staff turnover in 2019, we missed an opportunity to try to staff up at a time where we needed it. So unfortunately, our first opportunity to bring in another member of the staff would be in July. So we're already laying the groundwork, again, cautiously optimistic that we'll be able to do that. And I know what's really frustrating for applicants is the lack of transparency once their application is filed. Their only lifeline to receive any sort of update on the status of their application is a phone call or an email to staff. And again, that the volume is simply unmanageable at this point in time. So there are application systems where the applicant user can log in and view exactly where they are in the process. They can see exactly what has been submitted. Address some of the things that we're challenging. As much as we can remove that process, you know, from an email communication, I think that would achieve a lot of clarity that applicants would appreciate. The system potentially could, or a system could potentially allow for other verifiers to upload information and not have to rely on our staff to do it. So in other words, if I'm supplying a supervision form, I can upload that to the system to support an application, and it doesn't have to go into someone's email or, you know, mail to us where we have to scan it and upload it. So there are some efficiencies that we know exist. And I am, again, going to be recommending to the board that we take a close look at those opportunities, because we don't have them right now. We also don't have a system that is malleable to the extent that we can provide the degree of specificity on application requirements that we need. So we could turn on our system today, our online application system, but what we would find is that because we can't customize the applications, we would get material that, again, doesn't meet the qualifications, and we would just have to send it back. And in the process, we're just creating delays.
If I may take a second to introduce myself, my name is Ned Carlson. I'm a board member of the National Coalition for Access to Autism Services. which is made up of approximately 40 providers from around the country, many of whom provide services or even based in the state of Arizona. And we are one of the stakeholders who submitted a letter of mentioning some of our concerns or some of the experience, trying to share some of the experiences that our provider members have had in attempting to navigate the licensure process in the state of Arizona. First, I just want to thank everyone on the call and the board and the committee members for responding to our inquiry in a very detailed manner, and certainly for the invitation to participate in this call. To be 100% clear, our goal in terms of representing our members is to better work with and partner with the board to navigate and help develop a process where the appropriate and certainly understandable responsibility the board has to verify proper certification, education, training, supervision, to ensure high quality providers are being licensed and providing care in the state of Arizona. We obviously totally respect that and understand the goals and the need to do that. I think where our members are struggling is with, are the steps in the process aligned with and meeting that goal? And certainly appreciate the volume of communications, the lack of maybe the suitable technology to manage those communications and application process. Certainly the lack of maybe sufficient staff to support the volume. But I would imagine that most of the individuals on this call would agree that there is a shortage of licensed BCBAs in the state of Arizona to support the needs of the population of Arizona and ultimately the patients that need that care. And so really what we wanted to do was reach out, share our experiences, and see if there were things we could do to work together, whether that be helping, you know, refine the application process so that there isn't as much administrative burden, meaning when it gets submitted by our members or by our team members who work at our provider organizations, it's right the first time. Because I think what we've seen and what has been shared by our members with the board of NCAS is what Dr. Haas shared. It's not so much once the application is complete that there isn't a timely review, approval, payment, and issuance of the license. It's all of the things that lead up to that, where our members have reported, you know, 5-6 weeks of a delay in any response, which again, I can understand given all the issues that have been highlighted here. And communications from the licensing staff that, you know, the average time is going to be 5 or 6 months. So, and I don't know if the staff is taking into account when they share that with applicants, this pre-administrative review timeframe or not. But as recently as in the last month or so, we've had applicants receive notices saying, just be prepared, it's going to take 5 or 6 months. And so we certainly appreciate the data that you shared. And frankly, if that was the time frame that our members had been experiencing, we never would have submitted a letter. We wouldn't be reaching out. And I think you've made clear to this, the discrepancy is this initial period of time of review, potential deficiency, response times, correcting. And so from my perspective, I guess what I would welcome your thoughts on are the steps. And if the regulatory required, understood, you only have so much flexibility to work around them, but are the steps in the process leading to that enhanced review and protection for the residents of Arizona? And so what I didn't see in the letter, and I don't know if this is something you can share, is you know, what percentage of the primary source verifications actually lead to a deficiency? And so I know Dr. Wilson mentioned that that does come up, but is it 0.5%? Is it 1%? Is it not? And there certainly are other states that require primary source verification. There are many that do not. And I understood it may be an Arizona statute, and that's a constraint you guys are working under. But in, you know, Michigan, Ohio, Texas, some of the other states that we provide services in that have licensure, the average review time is 30 days or less. And my concern in Arizona is it's impacting the ability for new BCBAs or BCBAs from other states to move to Arizona to help address the shortage of licensed practitioners that can support the population. And then the second thing, I didn't know if you had data that you're able or willing to share, was of the applicant pool, what percentage are ultimately denied licensure? Because if all these steps created a tremendous amount of administrative burden for the staff and the board, but don't ultimately lead to a real filter on quality, is that the highest and best use of the board's resources? And so those were just a couple, I apologize for taking up too much time, but just wanted to share our members' perspective, offer our membership's support to work with the board and the staff to maybe do some reviews of applicant, you know, design so that we can make sure when somebody does apply, they're doing it right the first time. And just request for a little extra data to see if, you know, the obviously understood and supported intent of the process is actually having the intended impact. So thank you all for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts and hopefully look forward to being able to work with you all in the future to navigate this issue.
Mr. Chair. I appreciate that feedback. And I do want to reiterate something that you stated is, what can we do to make sure those applications come in correct the first time? And while I really think technology could solve a lot of that, but if we were to take that out, I wonder if there's some stakeholder education. And I don't know, oftentimes we're seeing when it comes to information being provided, it starts with that incomplete application, right? So they're missing a section, or they didn't answer a question, or they didn't, like, there's something there that, but then there's this other like area that we've talked about as a committee that I think is important. And perhaps this is where, you know, kind of stakeholder engagement and conversation can go. I don't know the solution, but, you know, for example, we may ask about, you know, criminal history, and someone may have a shoplifting charge from 15 years ago that's been quashed or that, you know, is hidden up somewhere. And they answer yes to that question and they provide a single sentence. But they don't attach the report. We don't, you know, the police report. We ask for more information. And then because we're working with a bunch of really detail oriented behavior analysts who are brilliant, they send us their entire life story. And then we have to sit back and be like, ooh, we didn't need to know all of that. And so I wonder if and this isn't the solution by any means, but I wonder if, you know, we're looking at the end goal being, how do we make that first application the go, right? Like, how do we make sure that it is as error-free as possible? Technology obviously would help. If they couldn't move forward without answering a question, that would definitely help. But if we also had some education around what information to share and what not to share and how to provide that information fully, because that's another, and I'm just going off of themes. One of the things that I do want to acknowledge, and this is not to dismiss any of the other concerns, because I think they're valid. Like I said, I you can go back to the meeting minutes from November. This has been brought up multiple times now, but I wonder too if, I wanted to bring up that, you know, in the last 2 months, we've also had applicants who literally passed their exam the month before. And so I'm curious how, like, are those individuals like submitting all of their information the day they get, I mean, now we've got the test results immediately, right? Before there was the 45 days that you'd wait for your test results and then you'd decide if you're going to send, like, are they like getting the test results and then filling that out? Are there employers? I see Carrie check, you know, I can imagine Carrie being like, okay, you're testing tomorrow. Here's your application. Have all of it done and ready to go. And then I can see Carrie sitting there checking off all of those applications. I think that's why she's smiling right now. But I don't know if there's other strategies that people can share, but we've been seeing applicants over the last 2 months that literally just took their exam, which means they have been able to get a complete application in and have all of their, you know, primary source verifications information submitted, and be on the next agenda item, be on the next agenda. And so I don't know how or why that's happening. This has been like, I probably reviewed an application 4 times just to double check the dates, because I was like, there is no way we're sitting in a February meeting and this individual passed their exam in January. But I think it goes back to that theme. And again, it's not to dismiss all of the things in between, because obviously those also need to be addressed. But how do we support the professionals in getting those applications administratively complete the first time, with no errors, with just the right information to let us know exactly what we need to be looking at? I don't know. I don't know if there's any stakeholders that have experience with how they're successfully doing this.
Dr. Wilson? It's yeah. Dr. Hawes again. Are you suggesting that the short latency to the application coming to you is problematic, or that it's just somewhat of an anomaly and interesting?
I think that short application shows that the process can work, that mm-hmm. we can get all of the pieces together and it work just fine. My interest is, and again, I don't know if anybody has any experience with applicants that have come through this quickly. My question would be to the stakeholders, what are they doing with their staff to get it? I mean, I don't know if they're coaching their staff. I don't know if they're starting the application process the week before the test. And so all they have to do, I don't know what it is. I think it, and I'm not trying to put the burden back on anybody. I just think that there's so many different kind of pieces that are moving that, you know, we need to address the technology issue. We've got a staffing issue. We've got all this. But if as stakeholders, we can get the applicants to really fill out those applications accurate, correctly, and get them in on time, you know, and meet those timeframes, I think that could help, because a lot of that delay is, you know, you forgot to check a box, or you didn't fully answer this question, or you didn't supply this explanation, or you've submitted paperwork from 3 of your supervisors, but we're still waiting on that 4th supervisor to send their paperwork. And so there's all these like things that delay it. And there's other delays, and I'm not trying to dismiss any administrative delays that are our responsibility or that are coming from the staff. I'm just trying to think of solutions for, because we're seeing pass exam on the next agenda. So the system can work.
One thing I'm going to propose and allow it to kind of marinate amongst the board and the committee is maybe a triaging of the level of incompleteness. One thing that we're seeing is it is a binary response to incomplete applications. Yes or no, right? If the latter is the response, no, this is not a complete application, then it falls back into that bin of incomplete, to which there is no kind of parametric discrepancy between, you know, an applicant missing 3 forms versus a person who wrote the wrong number, right? And so I know that creates potentially yet another strain on administrative resources. But, you know, I'm in thinking about what we've done. I sat on the board in Missouri, and that was one of the things that we did that kind of further or more quickly expedited applications through the process, such that applicants weren't awaiting a response from administrative personnel to the tune of here's the three forms you're missing. Rather, it was, we need you to just make an edit to this form and then we'll push it through. So that's one thing that I think is viable or worthy of consideration. Another thing is, you know, in the online, I think it was Ms. Pakkinen who mentioned that the online preparation is, or the online application process is one that's yet to be rolled out. Is that still the case? Are there any updates as to the time frame in which that might be available, or is it still, you know, the shine of the online portal is maybe just commensurate in terms of efficacy with that of good old paper and email?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer that question. And I've sort of been dancing around this topic a little bit just because it hasn't been addressed by the board. It will be on April the 8th. I know when you and I last spoke, I spoke with more confidence than I should have that we were going to be able to address the deficiencies or fix the deficiencies in the current system that we are using. The system has a well-deserved bad reputation. And I think that we've reached the point where we've done everything we possibly can to make the system work for us to meet our requirements and our needs. And I'm going to be asking the board to revisit this, this issue and potentially look at other alternatives, because I don't have the confidence that I expressed to you when we last spoke, due to a couple of setbacks. So I think that all of our stakeholders deserve a system that meets our needs and that facilitates efficient processing of applications. We don't have that, and so the board's challenge needs to be or is, you know, how do we get to that point? So I'm hoping that a decision will be made, and in a matter of a few months, we have a solution, and you know, we're not struggling with the issues that we're struggling with right now. If I'm understanding what you suggested that worked well in Missouri, and I'd like to explore it more with you, you know, potentially offline. I think one of the things that challenges our staff is that when we receive materials that we know the committee will find unacceptable, the challenge then becomes, you know, how do we try to address that in the administrative review timeframe to circumvent the committee having to take the time to, you know, address that deficiency. So by definition, the administrative timeframe should simply be document received, document received, document received. Okay, we can check all these off, but we try to do a semi-substantive review, whether we're authorized to do that or not. We try to evaluate that content, and we try to look for instances where we know the committee is going to say, no, that doesn't meet, you know, subsection whatever of the rule. So our goal is to bring as clean of an application to the committee as we possibly can. Doesn't always happen. You know, we certainly do try, but the more time that process takes in the administrative review timeframe, you know, that again, we want to get the application perfect so that the substantive review process goes quickly, the application is approved, and the license can be granted. And then to answer a question that was posed earlier, I believe the board has only denied one license application for a behavior analyst. But every set of meeting minutes will reflect what applications were found to be deficient. And so the minutes detail what was the deficiency and what the follow-up means, you know, what that entails. If a formal request for, you know, additional information or clarifying information needs to happen, if the committee wants to interview the applicant, which does occur in some instances. So the minutes are our best chronicle of instances where someone was on an agenda but didn't receive the recommendation for approval of their license that particular day. I would say on every agenda, there's at least a handful of individuals where, again, you know, we did our best to try to get a clean application to the committee, but the committee did find some deficiencies, and they have to be addressed.
Ms. Penitent, and Mr. Chair, I wonder, would it be fruitful for both stakeholders and the board to look at the proportion of rationale as to why a application is deemed incomplete? I think that that feedback to would-be applicants might be fruitful of, like, what are some of the big red flags that we would need to be mindful of? So as stakeholders, as Dr. Wilson provided, can walk its applicants, soon-to-be applicants, through those processes to ensure that those checks are being made.
To follow up on Dr. Haas's point, I would just offer up that I am certain that a number of NCAS members, and certainly the organization I'm a part of, would welcome the opportunity to, I don't know what the right term would be, but to partner with the board and the administrative staff to potentially create a work group where those of us who are supporting the submission of multiple applicants could walk through the application and potentially develop some FAQs, job aids, et cetera, so that effectively we're filtering the administrative burden away from the staff, pushing it back on to applicants or the providers those applicants either are working for or are going to be working for. This is something that we do as a provider, and I know many of our members do, when it comes to things like CAQH applications, credentialing applications for funding sources, whether it be commercial or Medicaid, certification processes, say for a behavioral technician, as it relates to RBT certification with the BACB. So this is something that many of our providers support every single day in multiple states and multiple application process. So if that would be helpful to addressing some of these deficiencies you see in the original applications, we'd certainly welcome the opportunity to work with you and provide some resources to help navigate it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would love to explore this idea. In a former regulatory role, one of the functions that I performed was to go to all of the schools in Arizona, all the programs, graduating the professionals that I was regulating at the time, and instruct the students how to apply for their license, how to apply for the examination, and how to apply for licensure and so forth. That's much easier to do for that profession than it would be for this one. But that being said, I still think there's an opportunity to create some educational materials that could be on demand, as you said, an FAQ. My vision, if we can get to this point, is that we actually have, we create an instructional video. So that's something that applicants can refer to and utilize as their initiating that process, and the video would contain all of the known, you know, pitfalls and issues that we've identified just over the course of, you know, the last several years, where, you know, this is, pay attention to this piece because this is required, you know, don't overlook this, and so forth. So, you know, when we get a functioning system, when we are able to increase our staff, I think that's the point in time where we can start being much more proactive in the way that you're describing.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Paganon, I think that this is the lowest bearing fruit. We have a lot of issues to cover to really expedite the process, and providing the stakeholder education is something that personally I've seen would be beneficial, even navigating to newbie CBAs who I have supervised, showing them where the statutes are, showing them how we navigate through the rules, and having them understand more than just what's in the application. I think that would decrease the response effort that each of the BCBAs is experiencing and potentially increase their ability to comply with what is requested. Because I don't personally believe we have any BCBAs who are attempting to do this incorrectly.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pecknon, I wanted to circle back real quick and answer. We have only one denial, but and then we do have kind of the RFIs, which is where we request additional information, which actually will take more time if we have to request it over the administrative process, because then it has to go through, you know, all the other timeframes. So if I review your application today, we forward it to the full, and we say, no, we need to do an RFI, it's going to be a month or two before it gets seen again. And so it can be resolved quicker prior to that. But there's one other group of people that I think is important to note, and I can think of four offhand, and I'm probably underestimating it, of individuals that they weren't technically denied, because a denial is considered disciplinary. But they also weren't eligible for licensure. And so we gave them the opportunity to withdraw their application. So that way it wasn't disciplinary in nature, but they were, for whatever reason, they, you know, let's say they didn't take coursework, which is, you know, you can become a BCBA without doing your coursework under certain requirements. If they did 750 hours of practicum and not the 1500, those sorts of things, they apply, they go through the process. In those cases, we don't deny, because it's really not intended to be disciplinary, but we do have this subgroup of individuals that when we do review their coursework and all of their other components, that they just don't meet the requirements, and then have to, or we give them that option to withdraw. So I just wanted to add that we have that group of people as well.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilson, do you have data about, and I'm sure you do, we love data. Do you have data around proportion of applications accepted given initial application versus those that are redirected due to their being incomplete?
I'm going to default that to Ms. Pecknon. I don't know, Dr. Stenhoff, if you had.
I was going to say the same thing you did, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Certainly. We've not compiled that data. A review of the minutes of the committee meetings would easily pull that information forward. So I can task myself, or potentially we're running out of time with our student intern, but she may have an opportunity to do that for us. So we could assemble it. We just don't have it collected right now.
Mr. Chair, I think I suggested or proposed it as consideration only to the extent that would-be applicants or would-be BCBAs who are LBAs would come with an understanding of here's an inefficiency in their attempts to satisfy the requirements set forth by the committee. Secondly, to also highlight maybe some of the inefficiencies in the application process. It would be interesting data. I'm sure that Mr. Carlson, as a rep of NCAS, would also be interested in seeing as well.
Yeah, I would just say that could also lead into the work group that I potentially propose, because if we had any level of specificity in why things are being denied, if there's specific areas of the application that are leading to the majority of the incompleteness or insufficiency to be accepted, then obviously we could work together to focus on those areas and reduce that that error in the process, and hopefully speed it up for a larger percentage of the applicants.
I just wanted to take the opportunity to also just let everybody know that I am meeting with Heidi in April to discuss a collaborated event between AZIABA and the licensure board. So, you know, again, happy taking lots of notes as far as, you know, what our community needs and what AZIABA can do to support, you know, here. So I can also update everyone, you know, once we've met and been able to talk about upcoming efforts.
Dr. Stenhoff, if I may, I do have a legal question-ish. As far as our authority or ability as a committee to do an ad hoc committee, because I like the idea of, we've talked about having these job aids in place for years now. And there's a couple of reasons why they aren't in place, just to give stakeholders an idea. One is that we recognized right away that some of the issues were application issues, and so we remediated those by editing the application. But I think if we had the job aids and we just updated stakeholders on those changes, or if we are like, we just need to, I think, rip the band-aid, get those job aids, and then edit them as we go along. This isn't a new idea for the job aids. However, the idea of doing it in collaboration with stakeholders, one, could reduce the time that it takes to do it, but two, also leverage some additional support. So my question is around some manpower support, because like I said, we could say we'll do it, but there's a lot of other things we're all doing too. But if we had an ad hoc committee, what authority would the committee of behavior analysts have? Is this something we would then have to present to the full board? Is this, what would be our options of being able to do something like that?
I would recommend getting approval from the full board, because the committee on its own does not have statutory authority to establish a task force or work group. So I would recommend at least getting approval from the full board.
And do you need a motion on that from the committee, or can the committee just direct myself to potentially present an?
Yeah, if there's a consensus that that's what the committee would like to do, then I would just recommend that be forwarded to the full board.
Yeah, I would be happy, Mr. Chair, to present that to the full board if we can have it on an agenda item, and also include the letter that Mr. Carlson and his group provided as just a point of reference of this is, kind of a pain point for stakeholders. We're trying to work. We do have a statute for collaboration with stakeholders. And so I think I could articulate reasons as to why we need to establish this ad hoc committee. But I would be happy to do so.
Yeah, Dr. Davis-Wilson, that'd be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I do want to, remind everyone that exactly what Ms. Galvin said, this committee is advisory only. So I think sometimes we tend to forget a little bit that this committee doesn't function with the full authority that that a board has. Staff has had a few conversations around, how do we improve some efficiencies given this arrangement and given this dynamic? We're trying to figure out ways that we achieve decisions are made, or we achieve certain things without this duplicative kind of action, first committee and then board and so forth. So I don't have anything, concrete in my mind. I am not suggesting here now and today this committee needs to be a board, but I do think that that's something that we have to be mindful of, is just the statutory construct and the limitations that this committee has. Do I think that needs to be revisited over time? Yes, I do. And I think that, there's data that can keep us, that can inform us about what direction to go, if any, what to change, if anything. So just some thoughts that I've had and just some conversations purely at the staff level.
Thank you, Ms. Pacnon. Any other comments on this item?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to, just so that, because I don't know, maybe it's just me and I overshare things, but I find that sometimes these processes are daunting. So it's like, great, we had this great conversation and we appreciate our stakeholders and we wanted to hear from you. And okay, conversation done. So I just wanted to kind of explain the next step. So what's going to happen now is, because of that limitation that Ms. Pacnon just discussed, we have a consensus for me to present to the full board the need for an ad hoc committee to develop job aids that would include stakeholder feedback. So what will happen, I don't know if we, do you think, Ms. Pacnon, we can get it on the next agenda? So it'll be on the April 8th. Okay. So we'll try to get it on the April 8th agenda. Ms. Pacman can send you the meeting information for the April 8th agenda if you want to be present for that. Like I said, we've got to get it approved by the full board. If we are able to get it approved by the full board, then and you guys, whether you're present or not, then board staff will reach out to you and we'll get the ball rolling. If we're not able to get it approved, then I think we need to come back to the drawing board with what types of options that we have. In the meantime, I'm hearing a recommendation, and I would support it, of maybe finding or pulling the data related to how many applications are administratively complete without you know, or from initial submission. And pulling some of that data to discuss, even if it goes into the discussion with the ad hoc committee, I think that would be sufficient data for that. And then I think, you know, one thing that I would encourage stakeholders to do right now is, if you have applicants that are applying, have a process to maybe have a peer review of their application. Or like I said, I know there's several people. I sit down with my applicants and go over, obviously I'm recused from any of their applications, but I you know, sit down with them and go through and just double check that, you know, the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. I also want to add that we do have a couple of things that we've been doing to help expedite the application process as well, is we have kind of an underlying, if it is just an edit that's needed to an application when it comes to the full board or when it comes to the committee, that we give staff the opportunity to contact that individual in between the meetings. So, you know, we review it as a committee and then we send it to the full board for approval. If it's something like, you didn't check this box or you didn't put your address or whatever, we actually just contact the applicant and say, hey, we need this by Friday so that we can get it on that agenda. So we are trying to expedite some of those. And then if we don't have a quorum, we have made the decision to go ahead and move those applicants to the full board for substantive review. Generally what happens if you don't have a quorum is then you just can't, you got to wait till the next meeting, but now we're saying, no, let's go ahead and move them forward and we can discuss it at that meeting. So we are trying to process those quickly as well.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Any other questions? Comments on that?
I just would like to again thank the committee members for the opportunity to share our thoughts and look forward to hopefully partnering with you to improve the experience for the applicants and expand care in Arizona. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Carlson. Appreciate you bringing in your comments as well.
And thanks, everyone. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Dr. Oz, thanks for sharing too. All right, any other comments on that item?
Mr. Chair, I'm full of comments. I apologize.
I shouldn't have asked the question.
I just wanted to extend out to stakeholders and to remind your other stakeholders that attendance of these meetings can really help expedite some of these processes too, because they can hear us have the conversations about the applications or where there's deficiencies. Or like I said, this conversation, while not as in-depth and not as solution-oriented, was brought up back in November as well. So I think having these opportunities to attend these meetings or to follow the agenda items to just say like, oh, this might be something that pertains to something that our members or our BCBAs would be interested in. And having representatives attend, we love to have, I mean, we've got several AZABA members in here as well. We love to have the stakeholders present. And I, for one, have learned a tremendous amount of things in the 11 years that I have been awkward, nerdishly attending every one of these meetings.
Any other comments, questions? Okay. All right. We are at 1.5 hours. Does anybody need a break or should we move on? Okay. Then move on. Here we go. All right, agenda item number 7, discussion with stakeholders and consideration and possible action regarding advancing competency-based supervision. This item relates to discussions that we've had with how supervision is being implemented in the state and the varying levels or ways that supervision is provided to our future BCBAs and LBAs. One of the proposals that we had or wanted to have a discussion on is whether the stakeholders in general would welcome or at least have a discussion about, do we need a competency-based supervision program in the state of Arizona? And again, I'm going to go back to an earlier caution I had on another item, but again, being too prescriptive, but also within some general guidelines of what that supervision might look like. So I wanted to open that up to discussion for anybody.
Dr. Stenhoff, this is Kyle Lanier. I tend to worry as well about being prescriptive, though I think competency-based supervision is a great practice. I think when you get into the space of regulatory, consequences, I'm not sure whether or not that's the best move forward for our practice.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and perhaps it's the lack of sleep, but the context of this particular agenda item, do we have additional context to it? Because this is competency-based supervision is in our code of ethics, which means it's adopted in rule, which means it is enforceable regulatory-wise. So I'm just trying to refresh my memory as to what direction we were going with this particular agenda item.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. Ms. Pakanon, can you address that, or do you want me to build that one?
Mr. Chair, I wish I could, but I can't recall the genesis of this agenda item. I know that it was on the January 22nd special meeting agenda, and it was just one of those items that we didn't get to. It probably came out of some other discussion, and so at that time and in that context, we understood what it encapsulated, but I'm not sure that I could express that right now.
I'm going to say where it probably came from, and we can decide whether we want to discuss that further. But as we all know, as supervisors or those of us who have supervised and have talked with our supervisees who have been in other agencies, we know that there's not a there's varying levels of degrees in which supervision is provided. Ranging from, sorry, I'm being really sarcastic here, but do you pass this test? Do we have enough documentation? Great, you're in. To, where Dr. Davis Wilson pointed out, competency based on the code of ethics that the BACB provides, the task lists that the BAC provides that are grounded in that. Mr. Leidinger, I you agreed with my point. I'm agreeing with your point. It's right on. I don't want to be too prescriptive, but at the same time, do as a community, and maybe it's not regulatory, but as a community, is that something that, might be addressed maybe at the state organization level, or, at least among those agencies that do provide supervision or individuals who provide supervision.
Dr. Senhoff, I think that you may have reminded me a little bit. I wonder if this was a conversation related to topics that the community stakeholders may want to see as patterns that we're seeing. And I'm thinking back to a complaint that we took action on back in the fall, that this individual had three or four different supervisors, and the quality of work that this individual produced as what he reports was a product of his supervision, which can go either way, I don't know, but being that I've seen similar products of poor supervision, I think that it may have stemmed from the idea of, if we're going to be talking with stakeholders, to let them know that there is a huge discrepancy in supervision and I don't think that you were being pretty sarcastic. I think having a pulse is one of the qualifiers for some of the supervision programs. And so I think now that I recall and thinking back to that complaint, and I'm thinking back to some of the things that we as a committee brought up to the individual were things that were basic competencies, basic task list items, basic ethics code items. And this individual was so humbled and so kind, and pretty much like there was no argument. There was no, this individual pretty much was like, but nobody told me. And I think that that's what this convert, if I'm recalling everything now that it's coming back to me, I think it was, since we're going to have the stakeholders, maybe getting the professional association to consider conversations with their members, continuing education opportunities with their members around the issues of competency-based supervision, because the more complaints that we're seeing, some of the answers we're getting from applications, I mean, are really, really concerning from a public protection standpoint. And we're not talking like advanced competencies. We're not talking about learning the ISCA and learning. We're talking about basic entry level, first level BCBA or first year BCBA competencies that are mind-blowing to these professionals that we're talking to because they've never been exposed to it. So I think that that was the basis of adding it to this agenda, was just since we were going to have the stakeholders to just say, hey guys, you really need to be educating the supervisors on the risks associated, because what ended up happening in that particular case is we called the supervisor, some of the supervisors to the table, because we were so concerned with the clinical output of the treatment that we were concerned as to how other supervisors were signing off on that. Because in this particular situation, there were two other supervisors that signed off on that treatment. And so I think that that's, the there were two sides to it. One, how do we continue to do professional education around supervision, competency-based supervision, but how do we inform supervisors of the liabilities that they face in the event that they aren't adequately supervising? And we're seeing this more and more where we're going, wow, we've got a licensee that doesn't know this, or maybe a supervisor from out of state that doesn't know these things. We need to call them to the table. So I think it was just, I think it was just more of a discussion to bring to light the frequency that this issue is coming forth to us, so that the stakeholders were aware that this is a huge issue and there's huge ramifications, and we're concerned from a public protection position.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. Any comments, further comments on this item? And as Dr. Davis Wilson pointed out, is maybe it's a discussion that the stakeholders take back to the community of behavior analysts and kind of maybe explore that further as well. But any other comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Brian Van Merton, and I'm treasurer and board member of AZABA. And I would just like to offer, I do agree, I think this is a community issue. And if this committee is okay, I can bring it to the board and maybe a SIG to develop some materials and maybe a presentation or training on that, because I know it is very real. So if that's okay, we can approach that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and Dr. Stenhoff and Mr. Van Meerten, I think that what really stood out for me in all of those conversations was, and we talk about it in ethics classes and it's in our ethics material, like ignorance is not a response that we can give to protect us, right? Like, we can't be like, well, we didn't know. And that's one of the things that we're seeing when we're seeing these deficiencies in clinical in clinical knowledge and clinical output. We're seeing this like, well, I just didn't know, or nobody ever taught me. And so I don't think that they understand that once you become licensed, you are independently practicing. Like, you can't say my organization said this is okay, so I'm doing it this way. Or my organization, you know, says that data is silly, so we're not doing any data collection. Like, we, those sorts of things don't fly once you're independently licensed. Once you're independently licensed, you're responsible for those things. And so we're seeing this kind of theme of, well, I didn't know, or my employer said, or so yeah, anything that we can do to kind of help. I think we just wanted to bring to your guys' attention that these are the themes, and that it's one that is concerning for everybody, I think.
Okay. Any other comments? Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Dr. Haas.
Is the question the extent to which the committee is involved in potential prescription of regulatory guidance around this, or maybe some clarification around the intent of the question or the agenda item?
Yeah, thank you. So it's more based on Dr. Davis-Wilson, what she was referring to a moment ago. We have seen varying levels of people have come through and with some issue with the level of supervision or the inability to match their supervision with the code and with the task items. So it's not so much what the committee will do, but more we're referring to the stakeholders of some issues that we've seen and encourage the stakeholders to perhaps make sure there's alignment between supervision practices in regard to the 8 hours that all supervisors have to do with the BACB, to aligning the activities with the task list items, to the code that the BACB provides. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question, Dr. Haas?
Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. Does the board have thoughts around how to communicate that at large? You know, at present, unless you read the minutes, and those of us who are on this very call, the extent to which that message is kind of echoed throughout the state is going to be, I think, significantly limited. And so it may be of importance or worthy of consideration of how that's communicated to the community. Yeah. And Mr. Van Meerten's suggestion is one avenue of kind of exposing that.
Yeah. And Dr. Haas, that's a great point. And to that point, that is the reason that we've called this special meeting, is to invite the stakeholders, primarily those from AZABA who represent the behavior analysts in the state. And while some of those some individuals are BCBAs in the state may not be members of AZABA, but we're hoping for information delivery in part, not only from us and your points well taken regarding the minutes, but also get a community collaboration between the committee, the board, and the primary association that represents the behavior analysts in the state. So, but your point is very well taken and certainly may be addressed.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, this is Carrie Baranek. At the most recent AZABA Public Policy Committee meeting, we spent a substantial amount of time reviewing the agenda items from the last committee meeting. So again, you know, to Dr. Haas's point, it's impossible to reach everyone, but these efforts are underway. We can't force people to come to a public policy meeting, but the information is out there and it's open to the public, or it rather it's open to anybody in the Arizona Association.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Haas, I think to kind of circle back to a little bit of maybe what you're asking, our role is limited here. And so we wanted to communicate there still, likely because licensure is still fairly new for our profession. It's not consistent across all of the states. It's not, you know, it's new for a lot of people. There's this expectation of some of the professionals when they come forward and sit before us to be like, well, who's responsible for telling me? You guys aren't communicating it to me. And we're not getting it from our supervisors. And at the end of the day, I think some of that comes from a misunderstanding of like, our role isn't to educate professionals. We license the professionals and protect the consumers. And so what we've essentially decided is that, you know, because it's such a new field and because there is this disconnect between kind of what is the role of the regulatory body and what is the role of the association, that as we see these patterns, that we would communicate that to the stakeholders and kind of put it on them to decide how they want to disseminate that information, because it's not a role that we can take. The role we can take is actions on the rules and statutes. And this competency-based supervision is in rule. And so it is important, I think, for stakeholders to understand that their members coming before us, we can't be like, oh, sorry, you didn't know, so we can't enforce this. If they come to us and they have no idea, they're facing potential disciplinary action. And I don't think that they understand the extent as to how that happens. And so we're kind of giving this courtesy to the associations of, hey, we're starting to see this theme. I don't think your members truly understand how problematic this may be.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. And to take a slightly harder line on this, we, through our ethics courses, and as the code is reviewed, there is a requirement for students, soon, you know, upcoming future BCBAs and LBAs, to know the code, to know the statute that they exist under, and it, you know, like Dr. Davis Wilson said, it's not our job to educate, but at the same time, we want to work with the stakeholders and the local agencies or state agencies to ensure that there's a greater likelihood that people are following statute and code and so on. So is that, yeah. Any other comments on that? Okay. All right, so thank you. Agenda item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the role and value of the BCABA in service delivery. So we've had some discussion about this as well, and I'm going to open this up to others who want to discuss that. But I think if I'm summarizing it correctly, and you know, my fellow committee members can correct me, but it's just the how are BCABAs being used? How do other agencies promote their use if needed? But just having a discussion on that. So I'd like to open that up.
Mr. Chair, I do have comments, of course. One of the things that I've seen and heard recently is that individual BCABAs or people who may be eligible for BCABAs expressing that they can't be BCABAs in Arizona. And I'm concerned because it's not necessarily true, but they're expressing that they can't find employment, that they're not able to be individually licensed, so they can't practice. And you know, it's when we talk about access to care issues and we talk about this need to be able to have our tiered services, you know, running in the intent that they are running, BCABAs can play a critical role in supporting the well-being of a BCBA, in helping with caseload management, helping with a bunch of other things. And so my concern was perhaps that we as a licensing board maybe have made it not, and I shouldn't say we as a license, I think the perception may be that BCABAs are, it's illegal for them to practice. I think that might be a perception. And I'm, and so the conversation that I want to kind of have is, how do we educate stakeholders especially being that there's a funding source for BCABAs in Arizona, you know, how do we educate stakeholders? And if need be, how do we make it clear that a BCABA can legally practice under their, under the, their position as a BCABA? Because I'm just concerned that it's being underutilized out of a misinterpretation that it's illegal. I don't know if any stakeholders have any experience with that or any employers that are experienced with that, but I mean, we now have the ability to bill BCABAs on all the access plans. So it's just a matter of how do we encourage that model?
Any comments from stakeholders or community on that?
I think our, just to speak as not as NCAS, but as Trump of Behavioral Health operating in Arizona and other states, I think what we have struggled with is building support systems around that role because there are so few BCABAs. And that's a longer discussion with the BACB and all of you who are behavior analysts in terms of how that mid-tier certification is designed and should it be evolved, et cetera. But I think the biggest issue we have is one of focus and supporting the various levels of clinical providers. And although there is a funding source in Arizona, where we have employed BCABAs more broadly, have been in geographies where there is broader funding support, albeit through whether it be commercial, government funded, et cetera. And so my perspective would be, it's not something that most providers focus on too much because there just aren't very many of them. And that's not just in Arizona. If you look at the relationship between BCBAs, BCABAs, and RBTs, people don't tend to stay BCABAs very long at all. And many of them, at least in our internal professional development and career support progress, they skip it entirely because the actual distinction doesn't provide them with a great expansion of their professional opportunities.
Mr. Chairman, I would kind of echo Mr. Carlson's points in that, and I'd also provide the variable of fiscal equity. You know, to what extent are organizations going to create infrastructure and support for BCABAs who have short tenure in those positions? You know, we haven't done those analyses within my organization, but I think if we were to do those analyses, the data might suggest that that the use of those very limited BCABAs may not be fiscally beneficial for the organization. That's speculative only, but there's a certain, and maybe there are many variables to the rationale as to why there's a decreasing rate increase of BCABAs. And I was just looking at the data on the BACB, it's markedly lower than that of either BCBAs or RBTs, and the function of that kind of decrease is probably multiply impacted, but how those are used within organizations creates a lot of tasks on resources to create an infrastructure of support. And so that's been our perspective to date. I'd be interested to see of the stakeholders who have infrastructure for BCABAs, to what extent is there long-term support for existing BCBAs, but also from a financial perspective, how does that support their, you know, their long-term goals?
Mr. Chair, if I may, one question I have, you guys don't have to answer it, but one thing that I'm thinking about, and then I'll go back to kind of just the purpose of why I wanted this added to the agenda. but with the new supervision requirements being 60-40 of unrestricted, and this is, you know, just something that I think about, you know, those students, those matriculated grad students and BCABAs can bill through the access plans, giving them an opportunity to get, for you as an organization, to seek reimbursement for those indirects, those 60% indirects that are going to be required. 50-50 was hard, 60-40, man, that's going to be tough. So with that in mind, the reason why I bring it up is twofold. I've talked to a few BCABAs who basically said, because who were under the impression, right, wrong or indifferent, that because they were not eligible for licensure, they could not practice in Arizona, which is why I wanted this on the agenda, is because if that's truly how people feel, then perhaps we as the regulatory board need to provide some sort of guidance around what the law means as it pertains to that practicing level. But what I'm hearing from stakeholders who would make the decision to hire or not, it's not a licensure issue. It's other fiscal impact and other reasonings potentially. But if I bring up then this idea, and again, we don't have to have an answer today, but if I bring up this idea of, okay, we've got all these supervisees who are going to need 60% of their 2,000 hours, potentially, all as indirects, well, then we kind of need them to be billing that middle tier. Otherwise, we're trying to convince them to work for free as students in that middle tier stuff. And if that's the case, and again, it doesn't have to be an answer now, if that's the case, is the interpretation of, well, as a BCABA, I can't practice in Arizona going to be a limitation for your organizations? And if it's not, that's fine. I just want to make sure that being that I heard from two different people, BCABAs are not allowed to practice in Arizona, I want to make sure that it's not a language issue that needs to be clarified from us as a committee and or board. But I am so far hearing it's probably more of just an infrastructure and organization issue, which is perfectly fine. I'm not set out to change that, except again, that little 60-40 nudge of how in the world are we going to get them 60% indirects if we don't have these opportunities available for them. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't anything else that we could be doing as a committee to bring down that potential barrier, if that was a barrier that stakeholders were experiencing. But this could just be a misunderstanding or something else with those specific BCABAs.
I'll just say from my perspective, at our organization, we provide services mainly to our access members. So we take full advantage of that trainee tier. Functionally, they are equivalent, a trainee versus a BCABA. We don't distinguish them. We use them in much the same way. I don't have any assistant behavior analysts, but mostly because no one has applied. But they would absolutely have the same opportunity, and I don't have a fiscal concern about that role. Just it's more of a lack of interest.
And I don't know if she's listening, but I see Ms. Bartels on the phone. I know her model, she usually encourages some of those individuals to go through the BCABA process to practice, you know, and prepare for the BCBA process. I don't know if you want to speak to kind of the process that you use.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I can. So we usually encourage our mainly supervisees, once they get to the point where they qualify for the BCABA, to go ahead and sit for that exam. There's a lot of reasons why, but to prep for the bigger exam is one reason. And then we also use that as like a pivot point to create like salaried clinician positions with very small caseloads, so that, or with very few assigned clients, they're still being overseen by a BCBA, but so that they can really then get a feel for what it's like to get into more case coordination and step into a significant amount more of those unrestricted duties before, just because we found that so many people really have a difficult time with jumping from I'm a technician and I've managed to get all my unrestricted hours and so I'm ready to sit, and then suddenly they have a full caseload and they really are just drowning in case coordination and all of the documentation, paperwork, billing, all of that stuff. So we've created sort of like a little subset, and we just use the BCABA as a pivot point. We don't have anybody who stayed there more than a handful of months. But if somebody were to do that, we would most likely treat the position in a similar way, which is they'd have a small caseload, where they would be seeing each client more intensively. But again, we haven't had anybody apply just for that position. It's only people who have been kind of, you know, crossing through. So, but it's been really successful, and the people who have done it have really felt like that was a really great opportunity for them to reach into that position a little bit more in a more gradual way, rather than just like a foot out the door. So I'm a big fan of it, but I agree, it's not something that we are really able to build any type of, you know, business model on. It's just what we kind of do to support our supervisees at this point.
Mr. Chair, I just, like I said, I just wanted it on the agenda to make sure that it wasn't an issue that we needed to kind of rectify, but it sounds like it's just organizational infrastructure.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Dr. Davis Wilson, I will add to this conversation as a previous BCABA who graduated into the BCBA. It was probably the most impactful part of my learning experience, which was done under some people on this call. So with that being said, I'm also in agreement that there's an avenue for it. And I think that it's awesome that we're having this conversation with stakeholders to talk about the potential of it, how we could arrange things. I think that Christina's comment is really interesting.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. All right, so let's move on. Agenda item 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding any other regulatory challenges and issues specific to behavior analysis. Ms. Pakanon, do you want to address that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. So this is just a very open-ended agenda item to allow for discussion of any issues that really have not been specified on this agenda. Maybe some things that you've been discussing this morning that you want to explore further here, or just bring new issues forward. You know, this just affords us the chance to have those kinds of discussions and maybe identify some topics to bring forward in future agendas, and some task the staff with research if needed.
Hi, this is Kyle Leininger. I did have a recent bill that was passed that I was wondered if other people had seen, but also just kind of understanding from board members how they think that will impact the practice, specifically Senate Bill 1269, which was passed on the 25th, which is relevant to political boards, politically appointed boards regulating the practice of healthcare professionals, and how that may impact the work done by our board.
Ms. Packard, are you able to address that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was just going to offer to do that. So yes, what's being described is essentially it emerged maybe 2 days ago as a strike everything amendment. The two previous attempts were made to essentially restrict local authorities, local governments, from in any way restricting the practice of behavioral health. So it does have implications, as I've heard from the profession, members of the profession, for conversion therapy. And there are, I'm speaking from a place of some degree of ignorance, but there are competing federal district court opinions about a local authority's or local government's authority to restrict this kind of practice. So this bill failed in the Senate, the original bill failed in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. It was then retooled and appeared on another Stryker bill. And I'm trying to remember when and where that happened, but that bill never was introduced to the committee, reportedly for lack of support. So then suddenly 2 days ago, Senate Bill 1269 emerges, and it was heard by the Committee on Criminal Justice Reform. So it did narrowly pass the committee review. So far it's only one hurdle, which is a Senate committee. But what it does is it restricts a political subdivision of the state from enacting any measure directing the professional conduct of a healthcare professional. So the board has not even had an opportunity to see this. It sounds like maybe the committee, this is new information to the committee. I'd be happy to share this with everyone. So that's where it stands. It's past one hurdle. It does have several more to go.
Mr. Leidinger, any other further questions on that?
Yeah, I just did have one question. That would still not influence the Board of Psychology Examiner's ability to regulate practice. It just prohibits local jurisdictions from restricting practice. Is that a correct interpretation?
So the provisions of the bill, it states the licensure and regulation of healthcare professionals, including the determination of unprofessional conduct, is as expressed in the Arizona Revised Statutes and the rules. So it maintains the Board of Psychologists Examiner's authority to make findings of unprofessional conduct. But it restricts a political subdivision of the state from enacting any measure directing the professional conduct of a healthcare professional. It defines healthcare professional as a licensed or certified individual who provides mental health therapy as part of the individual's profession. So what I'm reading and interpreting is that this bill, the Stryker bill, is less direct than maybe the two previous attempts to try to achieve this kind of change. But nonetheless, mental health professionals are seeing this as very much related to efforts to restrict, to prevent the restriction of conversion therapy. Did I say that right?
Yeah. Okay, any other questions on that? Okay.
I do think, Mr. Chair, if now that this bill has emerged, and again, it's made at least this incremental progress, it's going to appear going forward on with your committee briefs as we talk about bills and the psychologist examiners as well. So it will be among those that we discuss while the session is underway.
Okay, great, thank you. Any other comments or questions on that item? Okay, I proposed at the beginning of the meeting to move agenda item number 4 to this point. The item is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the model practice acts of the BACB and the APBA. Dr. Davis-Wilson referred a little bit to that earlier, I believe, but would somebody mind discussing that and where we're going with that one?
And Mr. Chair, just if the committee asked for this material, of course, to be for an opportunity to review this material. I know that there was one version of the MPA that you specifically identified, but I elected to bring both forward just for purposes of discussion and potentially comparison. So that's why you have both versions.
Okay, any comments on that item?
Mr. Chair, I think the purpose of bringing this forward would just be to crosswalk as we go through the other agenda item for edits to the statute to see kind of how the language differs or is the same. As I stated earlier, some of my concern is that even this document itself is a little bit more prescriptive than what our stakeholders have brought to our attention. And so I know that this is kind of this particular document is kind of Dr. Davies' wheelhouse. So I'm not sure what he wanted as far as the review of language and what that would necessarily look like. But I think it's just intended to serve as kind of a example per se to use as we work through other legislative changes that may be needed.
Okay, great. So why don't we save this for further discussion in the future? Okay. All right. So moving on to agenda item number 10, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations for revisions of the statutes that regulate the practice of behavior analysis in Arizona. Ms. Pakanon, do you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think that given there are some discussions that you want to continue having, maybe the only piece of this that the committee might want to address, and you know, we're at a deficit given that Dr. Davey is absent, but the language that prescribes the committee requirements. That's been raised a number of times specific to the terms, the term limits, the, you know, whether we have a bench of potential, you know, future CBA appointees. The other piece to that too, I think we're addressing the requirement to engage with stakeholders. So maybe that statute was only, or the concerns about that statute were really based on, you know, what do we do when we find ourselves with the current committee members reaching the end of their terms, and, you know, will we, how will the committee maintain its responsibilities if we're struggling to find people willing and able to serve?
All right, thank you. So I think in this capacity, do we want to hold off on agenda item number 11 for future discussion and then move on to agenda item number 12? Is everybody okay with that, or?
We still, are we still going through, or we're going to postpone until Dr. Davey, is that the suggestion?
Yes.
Okay. And then I think the discussion for agenda item 11 can't really totally happen until we finalize agenda item 10.
Correct. So let's move on to agenda item number 12, discussion with stakeholders and consideration and possible action regarding training opportunities for the behavior analyst profession. So Ms. Pakanon, could you kind of summarize that item, but we'll open up for discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I think that one of the outcomes or takeaways from these discussions is to, you know, help identify some important issues, some training opportunities that really are, you know, as Dr. Davis Wilson has said on a few occasions, they're not topics that the board has the authority to do much in the way of, you know, education or outreach necessarily, but they're great opportunities for the professional association to take the reins and really, you know, in with the support of the statute and rule language, and informed by the committee and the board's actions, to, you know, impart important knowledge on members of the profession. So I've heard a number of things identified today, and the state association representatives have been great about chiming in and sharing with the committee, you know, the sort of things that they're doing and, you know, some of the things that they're focusing on. But this is, I guess, you know, that opportunity to make sure that, you know, we take stock of all of those issues and those opportunities and potentially identify more, not that we want to overload the association, but these really are, you know, opportunities, I think, to strengthen the membership. And in the process, we should see fewer instances of complaints and non-compliance in the process.
Thank you, Ms. Pakanon. Any comments from stakeholders on this or committee members?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pakanon, stakeholders, everybody, hello. I do have a comment about the, we have an upcoming agenda item in the next, I believe it's the next meeting that we requested to have added to the next meeting. And I would like to just make sure that stakeholders are aware that it's coming up, and it's going to tie in to my comment. And that's related to potential lists of practice monitors. One of the things that we are going to continue to see a growth of, and not because of any reason other than we're growing as a field, is we're going to continue to see complaints come forward. And there's a lot of different established things that we can do to remediate complaints. And some of those things involve accessing qualified professionals to help provide consultation and supervision to licensees. Okay, so I wanted to bring that to everybody's attention that that's going to be a discussion, because I think that it makes a little bit of context when it comes to one of the discrepancies that we're seeing in the area of training. Part of it is this kind of misunderstanding of our role as a licensure board. And so we're trying to make sure that we're communicating to those stakeholders, like where you guys can provide training to your stakeholders and your members. But in looking at some of these themes, one of the other areas, in addition to supervision, which we've identified as being an ongoing issue, adherence and acknowledgement and maybe even reading the licensing act as it stands, the statute as it stands today, tends to be a theme that we bring up. But another one that we're going to start to see, and I think we're going to have limitations in qualified professionals to even support licensees through, if it gets to this level, is going to be in kind of the operations side. So being a behavior analyst, it's also running a business, because in some of the concerns that we're seeing, there's almost like an entirely different scope of practice that comes to being in a leadership position as a behavior analyst. And I think many of you guys have probably seen on a national level, this is a problem. People pass their exam, they think they can run a business, they're running a business, and they're, you know, getting themselves into some hot water. That's a theme that we see here in Arizona, and it's a theme that's starting to come forth to some licensing complaints that have been brought to our attention. And so that would be one point of education that stakeholders may be interested in, is this idea of you know, there are competencies around being a business owner and a BCBA, operating at a leadership level and being a BCBA, and that there's risks associated. It's not as simple as I'm a BCBA now, so I can go start my own business, but there's risks associated to your operations that have rippling effects to your RBTs, your supervisees, to all these other things. Risks associated to signing off on someone's treatment plan, even though you're not the primary provider. Those sorts of things are starting to be themes that we're starting to see. And a lot of them are not necessarily things that can be addressed from a CEU perspective. There's plenty of CEUs out there. But I think what is more effective, I mean, we know as behavior analysts that just simply providing a CEU or, you know, a webinar on, you know, how you should perform something or how you should follow an ethical code or what have you is not sufficient. They need immediate coaching and feedback. And so I think that in addition to understanding, hey, these are some of the competencies that we're seeing as themes, maybe tying into our next week's agenda, which we can't tie into today because it's not on the agenda item, but when we talk about it next week, going into this idea of it's not just the CEUs, but as a professional association, what partnership or role can we have in kind of identifying competencies of people that can do the one-on-one supporting of these members, the consultation and collaboration and practice monitoring, that where people would be getting behavior skills training and coaching and feedback in a more immediate fashion and not just a CEU event. So I appreciate all of the CEU opportunities that AZABA offers. But I'm wondering if a future discussion when it comes to training needs to also be how to address deficiencies above and beyond just a CEU event. How do we make for an environment where coaching and seeking consultation is appropriate? And how do we address, you know, one of the issues that, you know, I brought up is nowadays so many organizations there's not enough kind of consultative role type BCBAs. So many people are working under other organizations. And so how do those people who have these brilliant talents and the ability to support other organizations, how do they work around the confounds of a non-compete or not being able to freelance or those sorts of things? And I don't have answers for all of that. All I know is that we're starting to see that when it comes to training needs, back to the roots of our science, CEUs are not going to be sufficient enough. Some of these individuals are going to need skills training, coaching, feedback, frequent monitoring, these sorts of things that I don't know. Maybe it's been a conversation AZABA's had before, or maybe it's a new one to kind of talk about, but I don't know that CEUs are sufficient enough. And I can tell you that there isn't really a resource for us to go to say, hey, here's where you can get this coaching and feedback. Here's where you can do that, because everybody's kind of working for other agencies or doing other things. So I just wanted to, you know, mention when it comes to training that we might have to, in addition to following these patterns, we might have to start thinking a little bit more out of the box and mentorship programs or consultation programs that actually go back to the roots of our science, because I personally am not comfortable with CEU events remediating some of the deficiencies we're seeing. I don't think that aligns with our science. I don't think it aligns with what we know to be evidence-based, what we know to be effective. And practice monitoring, which is what it's traditionally called on the board, is more aligned with our coaching and increased monitoring and feedback and behavior skills training. But how do we bridge that gap? I mean, the solution can't just be, we'll do a CEU event, because some stakeholders, some members, some licensees need more, and there's not a place to really get those resources. And it's a little bit more challenging, because if I think on a national level, there's a ton of people that I would say, hey, call this person, call that, but they're not licensed here. And so then it's like, do they pay for that person to become licensed? Like, what does that look like? So anyway, I just wanted to throw out there that maybe a future conversation for the association would be opportunities above and beyond just individual CEUs. Because I like to create work for all of you. You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Mr. Chairman,
I can speak personally that AZABA gets contacted regularly by exactly what you're describing, folks who have either not met the requirements for licensure and are deficient and are seeking extra support, or, perhaps disciplinary action where they, you know, they need some extra support and they've self-identified, and we are not able to direct them anywhere. So yeah, it's very unfortunate. I also want to say too, Dr. Davis-Wilson, you know, you mentioned briefly this idea of BCBAs who probably ascend in an organization and then they lead an organization, maybe don't have a direct caseload, but the organization that they design directly impacts the clients that are served. This goes right back to our discussion about OBM. Who's the client here? Is the client the BCBA that's employed, or is the client the consumer that's impacted by these decisions? So I think this definition of client is really important here.
I know somebody else, it sounded like somebody else had a comment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may, Jessica Belokas here. Just speaking to that, I know I was recently contacted and requested to engage in a practice monitor relationship with someone from our community. And my question would be, you know, what would be the scope of that? You know, what are the limitations in advisement to that position? And, you know, there were a few details given to me that were recommended to this individual from the board as far as number of hours, but something for future consideration if this is something that's being recommended, you know, to folks would be just what would the parameters of that advisement be, and how would that, you know, as a licensee in the state working with someone outside of my organizational practice, what advisement would really have an impact on what they're doing and what would they be required to follow, are just some of the questions that I had for that situation.
I wouldn't want the committee to speak about any particular case. It's probably pretty obvious if you were just contacted recently, but in general, you could describe what a monitoring or supervision requirement may look like. It's going to differ from case to case, depending upon the facts of each case, and the requirements are typically spelled out in any order that would go out.
Mr. Chair, and I know Ms. Packman had a comment, but this is precisely, I think, why we have on the agenda item a discussion around this, is because I think as a field, like we don't really have a process. Like, I'll just tell you from psychologists, there's kind of a list that the board has established, and those individuals have a communication process with board staff. They're provided a copy of the order, those sorts of things. But that's all new to all of us. And so that's why we've requested it to be an agenda item on a future agenda. But I think those are all very, very important points. But I also want to point out that, and to Carrie's point, some people are proactively seeking this before it gets to this position, and there's still no resources to support them. There's a little bit more resources before it gets to this position, because then, you know, for those of us, like I am in the consulting world, but if I'm in a consulting world and it's coming from work here at the board, I can't, there's conflict of interest, right? Versus, you know, when I'm working with an agency in Colorado or whatever, it's very different. But sorry, Ms. Packman, you were going to say something.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee and stakeholders, I don't want to outline too much of this today because I'm not sure the agenda affords me that opportunity, but certainly on the second, I'll be bringing some specific suggestions that could, I see them as potential strategies to try to, build this list. And I think I won't go there, but I think that we just need to do some curation, if you will. And so I'm prepared to take that on and partner with the association in the process, because I think maybe the psychologist list, Jean would know better than anybody, Ms. Galvin would know better than anybody. The psychologist list probably just sort of grew and developed, you know, somewhat organically, but I think we need to make a little bit more effort on the front end, just to sort of explain the parameters and the responsibilities And, you know, there will be, I'm sure, some statutory language to be mindful of, you know, boilerplate examples and so forth. So so I'll stop there until we
have. I do agree that the psychologist list, you know, grew over time and organically. There are also individuals on that list who would also be available for the behavior analysts if it has to do with fitness for duty evaluations or substance abuse evaluations. And those individuals make up a decent portion of the list for psychologists as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I agree that it's kind of a stretch to a different agenda item, and I don't want to make that stretch too much so, but other than to give that preface of join us on the second if you want additional information. But I do think it ties back to this agenda item from a perspective of training to just start thinking about where CEUs in and of themselves are not effective, workshops with role-playing, modeling, and coaching and feedback and BS, those are all different, you know, learning modalities that we might be able to, you know, employ in the community to help bring these deficiencies up proactively for people. Cause like I said, there's people that are seeking this proactively as well. But I worry, and I'm at fault of it too. I worry that the constant, like, well, we'll do a CEU. I just don't think that that's sufficient enough for the types of deficiencies that we face as a field, not just that we're seeing here as a committee. Like we're seeing it in other practicum programs. We're seeing it on a national level. So it's, there are deficiencies that are field wide. But I don't think CEUs resolve the issue. That's just my personal opinion.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, let's move to agenda item number 13, new agenda items for future meetings. I think we've several been brought up, you know, in regard to data, information, and so on. Does anybody have any specific items to add? Okay. All right. Hearing none, do we have a motion to adjourn?
I'm moved.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor say aye.
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 Excuse me. Aye.
Thanks, Dr. Rates. Opposed? Okay. Meeting adjourned.